Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 9 a.m. February 22nd, 2021. With me today is Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Wilson, Senator Hoffman, myself, Stedman. We have two items on the agenda today. First item is for the chairman to change his mask. It's harder to, easier to talk through this one. We're going to have state debt summary, followed by the state savings account and cash flow, and we'll be working quite a bit on cash flow. But before we get started, I've asked the committee aides to hand out two items. We got a bar chart from Legislative Finance that was put on everybody's desk. It has all of the agencies. It also has the permanent fund dividend last year, and the governor's proposed budget is on there in blue for FY22. It'll give you the idea of the magnitude of the comparisons of expenditures between agencies. And I had him add the numerics on it, along with they added the cumulative total, running total, and also the percentage on the FY22 governor's budget. I thought that would be useful for committee members and the public. We'll make sure that's posted. And also the Jafonsi, this big sheet of basically cash positions in the state, and we'll get into that with a second presenter. So I just wanted to highlight that. So with that, we're going to start with a state debt summary, and then when we're done with that, we'll go to the savings account and cash flow. We'll see what the clock says today as we move through it. So we're going to start with Mr. Devin Mitchell, the state bond debt manager, and he'll have some assistance if need be by Mr. Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue. So with that, Mr. Mitchell, if you can introduce yourself for the record, and you've got kind of a long presentation, so we'll try to move through it.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. For the record, Devin Mitchell. I am the debt manager in the Department of Revenue, and I believe that you have the presentation queued up that we put together. And I guess it's an unfamiliar format over the phone, and so certainly, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be relying on you a lot, obviously. So I would begin within that presentation on page 2, which is titled State of Alaska and Other 49 States Ratings. And the purpose of this slide really is just to give a perspective of where the state of Alaska is at this point. As recently as 2016, the state of Alaska had the highest credit ratings from all three of the major rating agencies, AAA. And since that time, we've been downgraded a total of 10 times, 3 by Moody's, 3 by S&P, and 4 by Fitch, to have reached the ratings that we currently have of AA3, AA-, and A+, Fitch being the lowest of those ratings. All of the rating agencies continue to have us on negative outlook. Over the course of this last 5-year period, they have stabilized our rating at certain key times, but we've slid back into negative territory, which implies that there's a likelihood of additional negative rating action for the state's credit. And if you review the list of states, you can see that there are only 3 states that have credit ratings that are lower than the state of Alaska at this point. On the next page, page 3.
Pause for a second for titled, questions. It would be nice, titled, Mr. Mitchell, if you could
go ahead.
If you could please pause at the end of your slides, and I'll cue you up.
Yes.
So it'd be nice if you could take this slide and resort it. I know it's in alphabetical order. but I'd like to have it put in rating order, and you might as well just use the middle one, S&P. You got to pick one of them unless you think another rating ranking, you know, is more beneficial, and rank them from the highest rating on down to the lowest rating. And also, if you could give us in that a summary of the dates of the rating downgrades, would be helpful for the committee for reminder. Any other questions on the slide? If you go on to slide number three, please.
Okay, thank you. On slide number three, these are the general overarching issues that we see within rating agency reports, discussion of, and really since this rating slide began really back in late 2014 when we initiated conversations when the price of oil slid fairly precipitously from over 100 to something well below 30. And so the political challenges associated with that shift in circumstances, financial policies associated with that, and then kind of these underlying rating agency concerns with the credit generally. And so political challenges, the largest of which and really falls within both of the first two categories, is the difficulty in achieving a balanced budget. The state's been grappling with the structural imbalance since really prior to the drop in the price of oil 2013 through the current date. We're all deficit years from an unrestricted general fund perspective. And that, I think, is front and center throughout their list of concerns. And these other points, many of them just highlight how we've been dealing with that or why we had to deal with that, the decline in the price of oil, the ability of the state to absorb this deficit structure through use of prior year revenue that was saved within the constitutional budget reserve, the reductions that have been made to general fund spending, and the difficulty with achieving those reductions, and cynicism from rating agency perspective that we're going to be able to continue to adhere to those reductions in the future. There's always upward pressure on budgets. And then, of course, the gridlock over the permanent fund earnings use, the tension between the permanent fund dividend program, public service funding. Under financial policies, there really was, and this I referred to this on the prior page, when the state's rating had stabilized, when in 2019 Senate Bill 26 was passed and the percent of market value structured draw was created for the permanent fund through the use of the earnings reserve, at that point in time the ratings for the state stabilized. This was obviously a huge shift for the state, and the first time that the state had used earnings of the permanent fund for something besides permanent fund dividends. And the difficulty has become a recognition that draw with the historical revenue or traditional revenue sources of the state remaining depressed has been found to be deficient to provide for both state services, desired state services, as well as a desired permanent fund dividend distribution. And of course, we're all aware of the difficulties of the last, I don't know, three. Last year actually wasn't difficult. It may be as difficult as many years, but certainly the difficulty of trying to find consensus on ways to either spend less money or generate more revenue. Other than the passage of Senate Bill 26. And then the ongoing concerns that we hear about the state, of course, referring back to the use of one-time revenue in the CBR, that's been in our reports for some time, the comparatively large net pension liability, and that's relative to the size of our economy and population, the fact that they view our economy as being relatively small compared to other states' economies and narrow in nature, even though from an employment perspective, there's actually quite a bit of diversity. And then the persistent perception that the state's economy and revenue generation is predominantly reliant on petroleum revenue. And that's definitely shifted at this point with the introduction of the percent of market value draw on the permanent fund. And, Mr. Chair, if there were any questions.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Mitchell, thank you so much for being here today. And it's interesting to note that you mentioned Alaska's. There's only three states that have more of a worse credit rating, and that with a negative forecast, we could potentially risk being downgraded even further. The governor's proposal right now has a $350 million capital bond, geo bond proposal, and unfortunately the revenue generated by the state of Alaska under also the governor's proposals to be used to pay off or pay a dividend. What, in your professional opinion, do you think the rating agencies might look at a geo bond, a $350 million geo bond, where any of the revenue generated will not be used to pay down the bond, but instead be used to pay down a dividend? How might that affect our rating agencies and how our rating agencies rate of the state, as well as maybe even trying to sell that bond on the market? How might that be priced? Thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, the state's ability to sell general obligation bonds is going to be in place whether there's a solution to the fiscal structure or not. It's the reality of it is that if there isn't some significant forward movement and momentum on reaching a balanced budget in this legislative session, the state of Alaska is almost certainly, or should leadership should expect that there will be negative action taken on the state's credit rating. At least that's the feedback I've been given from the various rating analysts that follow the state for the three firms that rate the state. As far as our ability to sell bonds, the state of Alaska has a relatively small amount of general obligation paper out there. The market recognizes the strength of general obligation paper of states in particular, and there are many credits that would want to purchase those securities. And so while we would pay more to sell them in the event that the state is further downgraded, In the compressed interest rate environment we're currently in, the cost of that would be less than in a higher interest rate environment. So it might be something more in the line of a quarter of a percent rather than a half a percent or more. And so it'll really be, as we move forward, if there can be some progress on the fiscal issue, I think the geo bonds will fall into line.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Devin, I have a similar question, but how will the ratings fare from your viewpoint when last year we were had a $680 dividend and the governor's proposing something that is three times as large, and we just got a chart passed out by the chairman that was prepared by legislative finance, and this would be the largest appropriation, 32% of our budget, which would basically overdraw the 5% by something larger than a little under 10%. Do you have any comments on that and how that drastic move might affect our ratings?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, it's a multi-tiered question, and the impact of COVID-19 in the country and the state of Alaska is recognized in all quarters, and so there would be some mitigation for an overdrawing of the earnings reserve for purpose of stimulating the economy through a dividend distribution. We're seeing that at the national level to some extent, and in a state that was able to do that at the local level could piggyback on that philosophy a bit. But that said, an overdrawing of the earnings reserve is not going to be viewed favorably by rating analysts. They work with other entities that have endowments like universities, and they have very I don't want to say strict, but they have guidelines for how much is reasonable for withdrawing from those funds if you expect them to remain in place in perpetuity. And that is going to create a challenge for the state from a rating perspective in response to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Nick, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How much have the downgrades cost the state in additional debt costs?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. So again, right now, interest rates are extraordinarily compressed. If you looked at U.S. Treasury rates, a one-year U.S. Treasury, you're getting like a tenth of a percent on that security. And so if you're only getting a tenth of a percent, you have to pay a 25% penalty. It's just not that significant in nominal dollar terms. On a percentage, it's significant, but not in nominal dollar terms. So like I said earlier, for the state of Alaska, a credit downgrade might result in a quarter of a percent increase in cost of capital versus without the downgrade. And that you would expect that credit spread to be wider if interest rates were higher. So if interest rates go up, the penalty, if you will, for having a lower credit rating is going to increase.
Mr. Devin, if you could, for the public and a reminder for the committee, explain the difference between the credit rating downgrades on an initial offering versus a secondary market where most of our debt is traded.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So our debt is all issued in fixed rate mode, meaning that the interest rates for each of the maturities, and when you sell bonds, when we sell bonds, each year has its maturity. So it's different from a mortgage where you just get one rate and that's your rate. We get a rate for every year of the loan, and that's blended together to come up with the yield for the entire issuance. But once those different year maturities are sold with those coupon rates and yields of the day, they don't adjust for credit ratings. And so if there is a credit downgrade, the investors in our bonds are going to lose value rather than the state of Alaska. And conversely, if rates were to go up on our bonds, they would realize value from that trade occurring. And as Mr. Stedman, the chair, pointed out, it's really just the new money issuances or potential refinancings that the state itself would bear the financial burden of increased costs due to rating adjustments.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you explain, we understand the political challenge and the financial policies and the rating challenges of our downgrades, but how does the strength of the Permanent Fund Corporation overall, I mean, that should show some stability within our with our state.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, definitely, yes. And In last year's presentation, we showed a couple of slides that we've been working with to try to further educate our analysts on the strength of the permanent fund, the fact that we're now getting the majority of unrestricted general fund from a sovereign wealth fund. It's not really reliant on the state of Alaska's economy, and so focusing on the state's economy is a faulty analysis in our case, since we have 3,000 plus different investments that the permanent fund is making throughout the world that really is the basis of our primary revenue stream at this point. And there was, prior to 2019, a skepticism that the state was ever going to use the permanent fund for anything but a permanent fund dividend, and especially after the advisory vote back in the late 90s, where I can't remember, it was 80-some percent of the voters said that they didn't want to use earnings of the permanent fund to pay for state services. And so that's definitely the strength of the permanent fund, and the current structure of the permanent fund has created significant strength for the state. And there's a slide in a couple of pages that if you look at where we would be without that POMV transfer, it's a lot more stark picture than where we are.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. So, Mr. Mitchell, I just wanted to kind of let the public know that you talked about 0.25% with rates being so low these days. 0.25% is really not all that much. Just to kind of put some context on it, for $350 million, if we had this GO bond, 0.25% of that is $875,000. 0.5% of that, of course, is double, $1.7 million. So, $875,000, is that significant? My book, it is. How many programs are worth in our budget $875,000? How many grants we provide for $875,000? How about how many leverage funds we do with federal highway money that we could use $875,000? My opinion is, when we have savings by 1,000 cuts, no cut is too small. If we watch the nickels and dimes, the dollars will follow.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just curious about the efforts that are being made to maybe get our message out a little better on our credit rating. When I look at the next presentation, it's got a number of days each state could run on total balances, and Alaska has the biggest savings account in the United States by far, over 170 days. And when you compare that to other states, like Illinois, for example, 4.7 days, Kentucky, 8.1 days, Pennsylvania, not even a day, a third of a day. And we've got the permanent fund with over $70 billion in assets, churning out 7% rate of return, 6.9%, up $4.8 billion per year. I just wonder if we can do a better job of getting that message out that we're actually in pretty good financial shape as a state.
I think you could try to partially answer that. That's getting into the next presentation, and most of that is sitting in the earnings reserve, the permanent fund, which has some other issues. But if you could give a brief answer to that, I don't really want to jump into the next presentation on the third page of this one.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. Those are points that we make in every one of our rating presentations. And so I haven't provided you, I'm happy to provide you with the last rating presentation that we made to rating analysts. But we generally have a, 30-page presentation in that ballpark anyway, where we discuss the various strengths of the state of Alaska and try to point out nuances of the credit that might not conform to some of their scorecard requirements, but are so overwhelming that they should provide additional strength to our rating. And in fact, if you looked at their discussions, you would find that that based on their scorecard, the state actually might achieve a lower credit rating than we wind up with, and it's due to overbalancing or let's call it extra credit in categories like reserves.
So if you could forward that last report on to the committee, and we'll pass it out. And but we'll bring up Senator Wilikowski's point here in the next presentation, because that is one that's going to take there are several pages dealing with that issue, and I'm sure we're going to have a robust decision or discussion on it. But I think to the broader point that was trying to be made is we've had difficulty over the years with the rating agencies recognizing the permanent fund as an asset that we have. And some of us feel like we don't get enough credit for it. So we'll talk about that a little later. So we did put this presentation along with the Revenue Commissioner back-to-back for the very reason that Senator Wilikowski brought up, that they're intertied together. So if we could go ahead and if there's any other questions on this slide. Okay, if we can go on to slide number 4.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, again, this is the most pressing issue for the state from a credit perspective, and it's the recurring fiscal deficit, the structural imbalance that the state's been experiencing throughout this chart's history from 2013 through the present and continuing on most likely through 2022. I shouldn't say most likely. I should say with the proposed governor's budget. And if you look back, and we could run through this quickly, the general purpose unrestricted general fund revenue back in 2013 was just under $7 billion. That was at an oil price of about 105. And you see that number decline in 2015 as the price of oil declined in late calendar year 2014 through the first 6 months of calendar year 2015 to about half of the 14 number, and that was really a one of the critical junctures for the state. And you see that revenue dropping in 16 and 17 to $1.5 to $1.3 billion, and then 18 recovering to $2.4 billion, and then in 19 jumping to $5.3 billion. And that jump in 2019 was really the result of the percent of market value transfer from the earnings reserve of the permanent fund in, of $2.7 billion. And without that, the revenue, the traditional unrestricted general fund revenue for that year would have been $2.6 billion. And the same, for 2020, it would have been $1.6 billion. And for 2021, $1.3 billion. So significant depressed consistency in revenue generation absent the POMB transfer. The other difference that started in 2019 was appropriating the dividend from unrestricted general fund rather than directly from the earnings reserve. And so the number that's reflected as unrestricted general fund is actually something less, again, using that historical standard of the dividend being drawn directly from the earnings reserve than the amount declared. So we've shown it just as a reduction in our table. The recurring and discretionary general fund expenditures, you can see the significant reduction from $7.4 billion in 2013 to $4.6 billion in 2021. The kind of the persistent nature of the deficit that if you deduct the POMV transfer in 2021 and you have the $1.332 million of traditional unrestricted general fund revenue left, the deficit that year would have been approximately $3.2 billion. And so it's I think this is what I was talking to on the prior page, the difficulty in narrowing that deficit other than through the positive step of creating new unrestricted general fund revenue that occurred in 2019. The positive story that I see on this slide is in the net position column, the state of Alaska total primary government net position, that in 2013 it was $76 billion, and then you look at 2019 and it's a little more than $76 billion, and you go, how is that when the state had a deficit every single year, and those total $16.6 billion. And it's that culture of savings, and this is another one of the rating agency points that we make, is the state has had a strong practice of restricting money for no purpose other than to save it for the future. And that is an unusual circumstance. And it results in declared dividends in many years where there, I'm sorry, in declared deficits in many years in which there was actually no deficit at all. So again, if you look back at 2013, you can see there was a declared deficit of $526 million, but the change in net position was positive, $5.8 billion. And so that money, in this instance, would have been money that flowed into the CBR from settlements. It would have been earnings of the CBR. It would have been money that flowed into the permanent fund from current year royalties, and it would have been earnings of the permanent fund. So you can see there was two negative net position years that were fairly large in 2015 and 16 that balanced out the balance of the other years. But still resulted in us having a slightly enhanced net position from the beginning of this experience.
Go ahead.
If there are any questions on the slide.
Yeah, there is. I'll get to that in just a second. I'd like you to go ahead and add another column, if you could restate this. Earlier on the slide, you were talking about the added percent of market value draw, where we go from 2018 to 2019, the significant jump from $2.4 billion to $5.3. If you could add that POMV to a column next to it so it's clearly delineated and make it easier for people that aren't watching the presentation to recognize what's going on here. And I think on your final comments, you were talking about reoccurring revenue, including profits of the permanent fund, if we were in one-year silos of total revenue generation to total expenditures. Isn't that not correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that net position would be all revenue, not just what we call unrestricted.
Right, and we've had that before here. So, Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Mitchell, I see these three bullet points below the table, and the bottom bullet point says the governor's budget has proposed drawing just $39.6 million from the CBR, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, for fiscal year 2022. That may be true, but I do believe we've seen previous presentations here at this committee that the governor's deficit is, in fact, quite much larger than $39 million, to the point of well over a billion. If we're not going to take the money from the CBR to cover this budget deficit, where, in your opinion, are we going to take the money?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair. So that was, if I am understanding the proposed budget correctly, the $39.6 million draw on the CBR was before a permanent fund dividend distribution. So any distribution of dividends in the coming fiscal year would be the draw where the money would come from, and the only source for that distribution is the earnings reserve that I'm aware of.
Okay,
and a follow-up question. So if we took that money from the earnings reserve in an ad hoc draw, that would be then taking more than 5% of the allotted POMV, the percent of market value. It would be more like in the 6.5%, and I think you mentioned earlier that Callan and Associates, of course, estimate 6, I think, and a quarter for a return. I think they just recently downgraded that. If the state was going to take more money out of the permanent fund earnings reserve above and beyond the 5%, how would that affect our ratings?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, as we discussed earlier, I think that there's a rationale and a logic to why you would take that action that from a policy perspective could warrant it, but from a ratings perspective in isolation, it's going to run afoul of their expectations for the use of an endowment.
Thank you.
So it's going to have a negative effect.
Senator Wilikowski, did you have a question? Okay, any other questions on this slide? Okay, seeing none, we'll go on to the next section.
So the next section is state debt and general fund obligations, moving away from credit ratings. And this is a little maybe more mundane, but we can run through the various obligations that the state has outstanding right now and have that discussion about how they're authorized and where the all forms of state debt are authorized by law, and so there needs to be a statutory framework to authorize the commitments to be made. There can be one-time issuances like general obligation bonds or certain other standalone transactions, or not to exceed issuance limits that are more in line with a public corporation or like the various public corporations like Alaska Housing Finance Corporation or the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank or ADA or Student Loan Corporation or the university for that matter. There's also certain revenue structures, although we have fairly limited opportunity for revenue structures in the state of Alaska. That is a revenue bond structure where you can irrevocably commit revenues from some activity or some revenue source to a bond issuance, as our state's constitution prohibits the dedication of revenue other than certain limitations. Generally, if the dedication existed before statehood is allowed by our constitution or is required by federal law. In addition to legislative approval for general obligation bonds, there's also a requirement that voters approve them. GO bonds are the only securities that we issue that have the full faith, credit, and taxing authority of the state backing them. And so it's the highest credit pledge that the state can provide, and therefore we get the highest credit rating and the lowest cost when we issue those. The direct state debt, the debt that is that's going to be paid by the general fund, must be structured and authorized by the State Bond Committee of the state. The State Bond Committee is comprised of three commissioners within the administration, Commerce, Revenue, and Administration. And that would include securities like GO bonds, subject to appropriation issues like certificates of participation, or these revenue bonds that might be sold by a third-party issuer but still are committing the state's payments to the repayment of those bonds. The State Bond Committee would need to approve those, as well as state revenue bonds. As far as the structure and timing, the committee determines when that would be most appropriate, and also is involved in credit and debt capacity. The state has other obligations. We listed a couple of them here, reimbursement programs like the school debt reimbursement program, and there's this transportation and electric utility reimbursement program, House Bill 528. There's also public corporations of the state that I referred to earlier, the university, that both have or all have authority to issue debt that's granted by the state. And then the largest category of commitment that the state currently has is related to the retirement systems of the state, which if you went back in time to around 2000, there was no commitment. The systems were declared to be entirely funded. And then through a combination of a circumstance that funding was found to be inadequate, and that's been determined to be a constitutional commitment of the state and therefore not non-dischargeable. And it's, as I said, become one of the largest or the largest commitment of the state. And that concludes my discussion on that slide, Mr. Chair.
I think some of this stuff coming at us here, depending what the committee wants to do, we might want to accelerate through it and then slow down when we get into areas that are more of more pertinent to what we're working on. Okay, next slide, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, like I said, this is maybe the mundane portion of the presentation. On page 7, this table comes directly out of the state debt book that I saw you guys were provided a copy of, or the with the packet information for today. But just to run through here quickly, state debt, general obligation bond, and this is as of June 30, 2020, $624 million, and that didn't include the final issuance of the 2012 Transportation Act of $84.56 million. The state guaranteed debt, this is also guaranteed or a full faith and credit commitment of the state, but always has been paid by Veterans Mortgages, so the HFC Veterans Mortgage Program, $94.3 million. State supported debt, which would include one certificate of participation for a housing facility at the ANTHC run hospital in Anchorage, the Alaska Native Medical Hospital. And then lease revenue bonds, which would be Goose Creek and the Lenny Facilo parking facility in Anchorage, $182 million. Then we have state-supported municipal debt through the school debt reimbursement program and that capital reimbursement program I referred to earlier. As a side note, neither one of those programs, the reimbursements were not funded in FY21. And so the municipalities have been paying those obligations out of local resources in whole or in part for the last 3 years. Then the pension system unfunded liabilities that I discussed on the last slide, those total $6.2 billion. And so, again, like I said, the largest commitment of the state. State moral obligation debt, which is a form of credit support that the state has provided to allow interest rates to be reduced on loans that otherwise would have been made at higher rates. And so it's really just a means of lowering interest rate on money that would be borrowed anyway for various state purposes. And that would include the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank, the Alaska Energy Authority, and the Alaska Student Loan Corporation, $1.1 billion outstanding. State revenue bonds, bonds. The sport fish revenue bonds were paid off in July, and so those are no longer outstanding. And we have the Alaska International Airport System revenue bonds, $333 million. And then this slide is continued on the next page, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and continue.
Okay. The university then is also listed under revenue bonds, $258 million, and they also have some lease liabilities, $14.4 million. Total revenue and university debt outstanding, $600 million. And then the next two categories, state agency and state agency collateralized, are really bonds that are secured by sources where the investors wouldn't expect to look towards the state in a significant way, meaning that, like, you have HFC's collateralized mortgage bonds. You have the tobacco settlement asset-backed bonds, which are backed by a master settlement agreement. You have the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Coastal Energy Loan Bonds, which are facilitated by the bond bank, but there's no credit pledge provided for those loans. It's through a direct NOAA loan program. The ADA power revenue bonds, which are paid from the contracts with Snedisham. The other interesting thing here is there's a couple of lines for state capital project bonds under state agency collateralized for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and those total just under $1.3 billion. And that same structure is, again, proposed for this year, where HFC would issue capital project bonds for projects as directed. And, Mr. Chair, that concludes my discussion of that slide.
Senator Hoffman and Senator Wilson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have a question regarding the consideration of refinancing given the low interest rates hovering around 2%. Is that a possibility, and what is the administration's position on that?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, that's definitely on the fore of our minds that rates are low. The difficulty in some instances is that the ability to refinance bonds in advance of the call date has been diminished. And so when municipal bonds are sold, they're almost always sold with a 10-year par call these days, meaning that the bonds cannot be refinanced for the first 10 years, and only the bonds that would mature after the first 10 years would be refinanceable for economics at all. And prior to the 2018 Tax Act at the federal level, we could do what's called an advance refunding and use tax-exempt bonds to fund an escrow that would replace the debt service for the current bonds with the refunding bonds. And that was eliminated in 2018, the ability to do that. And so at this point, if you're going to refinance bonds before the call date, that is before the first 10 years have run, you're limited to considering using taxable bonds. And so it changes the equation a little bit because you're giving up your tax exemption. The result of that is that you're going to pay higher interest rates. And right now, the way the math works, the bonds that the state has outstanding don't pencil out from an economic perspective for refinancing.
Okay, thank you. Senator Wilson.
Hey, Mr. Chair. I didn't see the $39 million that ADA for the revolving fund bonds. Were those fully paid off?
I'm sorry, Senator Wilson, to which bonds were you referring?
The ADA revolving fund bond.
I think that would be included in one of the, like, let's see, do.
Well, you can get back to the committee on that answer,
yeah.
So it's accurate. We have other questions on this slide? A follow-up question, Senator Wilson? Okay. Next slide, please.
Okay. I'll get back to you, Senator Wilson.
Get back to the committee, and we'll disperse the information to the committee members.
Yes. On page 9, then, we have a couple of charts that show the State of Alaska General Fund debt service payments. And so this includes state general obligation bond debt, state-supported debt, and then state-supported municipal debt. And that last category still is the largest category of commitment. Of course, like I said earlier, the 2021 appropriation for that purpose was zero, but we still show it as a commitment because the statutory framework is still there, and I know the municipalities are every year still hoping that the state will provide that funding. But in any event, you can see that we're declining from the peak of $225 million in 2018, and that if you looked forward 8 years, 50% of the outstanding securities would have been repaid. And so what that tells you from an issuer perspective is that we have what's called a mature portfolio that has headroom for additional issuance. If you were to, for example, say I want to target a level of $100 million per year, you could sell debt that would provide for payment from capitalizing interest or other means to avoid payment until 2030 and then backfill that where our chart on the top starts dropping off, you would have debt service out in those years that would result in a infusion of capital today if you had a target like that. I'm not suggesting that that's what should be done. I think that the historical practice of issuing bonds with 20-year level debt services served the state well, that you're always looking forward to the next year where things are going to be a little bit better from a debt payment perspective. And then down at the bottom, we have a chart that just shows the overwhelming nature of the PERS and TERS special funding payment. And so this isn't the percentage of payroll payment that the various PERS and TERS employers pay. This is the state's payment that it makes annually to keep the PERS employer contribution at 22% and the TERS contribution at 12.56%. And the top chart is actually incorporated into the bottom chart, and it's very difficult to see the remainder of the general fund debt service payments when you layer on top the PERS and TERS commitment.
Senator Von Immel.
Mr. Chair, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does it make sense, do you think, to – I see that the next slide I am looking is you are talking about the $350 million GO bond and the $100 million AHFC revenue bond proposals. Do you think it makes sense to maybe just restate this particular graphic slide, the top one, with overlaying the GO bond on it, like what it would look like? Because, I mean, if you look at the additional payment in 2024, it's $73 million, you know, out of a $225 million annual payment, you know, it's about 32%. So it's material enough that maybe we could add like a pink area or something just to kind of see what it would look like if we did these bonds and how much it would add to the picture.
We can have him do that. Other questions?
Yes.
Okay, next slide, please.
So this next slide is intended to address some of the last questions concern, but there's a summary of the GO bond structure that again, full faith and credit, and the various approvals that are required. The first bond issuance, this says likely in 2023, and it really is going to depend on when voters can consider the proposition, how quickly that might be, and then a matter of the types of projects that are included in the GO bond and when they need cash. And so if we have an ability to have an election and the voters consider a proposition relatively quickly this year, then it's likely that we're going to have debt service in FY 2022 rather than 2023. And that would be because you sell bonds with 6 months interest payment periods, and there is an ability to have what's called a long first coupon to some extent where we might be able to stretch out the first coupon period, and that would be the first period on which we pay interest expense to 8 or 9 months, but trying to stretch that out to 14 months, for example, with the other credit concerns that the state has, I think is going to be a more difficult sell than biting the bullet and having a shorter first coupon that's more in line with what the market would expect.
Okay, I think when we come
and then,
back, are you done with the slide?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Are you done with the slide?
Yeah, no. The only other I would just mention that it also shows these revenue bond category for AHFC as a reduction of the UGF dividend, and I'm not sure how AHFC would structure that if they would sell it as a general obligation of the corporation, but it would be secured by revenues derived from AHFC activity.
Right, and we're going to go into this in more detail in the capital budget. We'll have that request that Von Imhoff made here a couple minutes ago about having those debt service included in the current debt service schedule coming at us. So we see it in the entirety. But this concept's a whole different discussion on that bond package and if we do it, how we're going to finance it. But I think you'll find the committee's going to be rather reluctant to play financial games. And we want to keep it, this budgetary mess as transparent as possible and keep it unwind. So just be advised of that when you're working on your bond scenarios. Do we have other questions? Okay. Next slide, please.
So limited state short-term debt obligation alternatives, and really, we've provided this slide in the past. I think that it highlights limited is the key word in the title, that we have bond anticipation notes, which is really just a technique where there is authorized debt to avoid issuing long-term debt because of either uncertainty or a desire to stay on the short end of the yield curve. And so, as I said earlier, when you sell bonds, each one of the bonds, each one of the year's maturities that you sell has its own distinct interest rate. And so where you said if you were sub 2% on a 20-year borrowing, on a one-year borrowing, it would be 20 basis points or 0.2%. And so if you don't need $100 million that might be approved, you only need $20 million this year, then you can sell $20 million and pay 0.2% instead of selling the entire $100 million and having to pay 2% in interest expense. On revenue, and that I think is structured appropriately and works well for purposes that this states needed it in the past. Revenue anticipation notes is a means of funding an intra-fiscal year, that is within the fiscal year, cash deficiency. And it's unlikely that we would be able to sell any kind of cash deficiency financing on a tax-exempt basis just because of the permanent fund and the projected earnings of the permanent fund, which would have to be included in their entirety in the analysis for determining if there was a bona fide cash deficiency. But these are fairly limited in their application, meaning that you have to sell these notes for specific periods of time for specific amounts, and there's a ramp-up period associated with putting together the disclosure document associated with selling those notes. And there are other forms of short-term borrowing that can be established in today's markets that are more ongoing, either commercial paper programs or lines of credit that could be more nimble than this, than the revenue anticipation note model, which has been around since the 1960s. And that concludes my comments, Mr. Chair.
Okay, let's go on to the two slides down.
Yep, so 13. State debt capacity is the next section, and I again noted that you were not provided the debt affordability analysis, which is currently on the Department of Revenue Treasury Division's website under debt management publications. And so we'll make sure that you have that after the hearings, and I apologize for you not having it for the hearing. I do know that Senator Wilson was able to get it, I hope he was, because he reached out, or his staff did late yesterday and asked. So, again, my apology. The debt affordability analysis is required by a statute that was passed in the early 2000s, or a Representative Hawker statute that requires the report be delivered by January 31st, and it was posted on our website last week. It requires that we do a number of things. We discuss credit ratings, current debt levels, history and projections. The debt capacity analysis is really targeted on our debt ratios as a percentage, so our debt service as a percentage of unrestricted general fund revenue. And the historical perspective that quant method that pre-existed the debt affordability analysis being prepared was 5% of unrestricted general fund revenue was an acceptable level for general obligation bond debt service. And that was it. And then in the early 2000s, we added an 8% metric that included other payments that the state was committed to making, including municipal debt and other state-supported obligations. Those ratios then, when the PONV structure was created for the permanent fund in the revenues, unrestricted general fund revenues increased so significantly in 2019, we reduced those ratios because of the uncertainty about whether or not that was in line with the historical categorization of unrestricted general fund revenue, meaning that there were other commitments on that money, which specifically is the permanent fund dividend program. And so there's other various information that's included in that report. The main takeaway is that it determines a long-term debt capacity with maintenance of current credit rating level. And so I guess the final point is it does not include state agency by state agency, I mean public corporation, general obligation, revenue bonds, or state of Alaska revenue bonds, as each of those carry their own credit rating and their own debt metrics. If there were any questions, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Okay, we'll go on to the next one. We want to pick the pace up a little bit.
Okay. This slide, I think the takeaway is that there is no authorized but unissued general obligation bond authority out remaining at this point. And so I think we've talked about everything else on this slide. If you want to pick up the pace, we could skip to 15.
So just to restate that, all authorized issuance have been issued?
Yes.
Okay. Should we have any concerns on being timed out with IRS rules on usage of the money?
No, I don't believe so, Mr. Chair. The 2012 Transportation Act was the last bond issue or bond authority that was provided by the voters and legislature. We'd sold the majority of that through up until 2020, and the last.
Go ahead and unmute him. We want to pick the pace up, and please answer the questions more succinctly.
Sure.
Page number 15, please.
Yes. So the January 2021 debt affordability analysis, we estimated capacity for this state of $1 billion with the caveat that the state might be downgraded anyway. We just don't believe the state would be downgraded beyond the levels that it would be downgraded anyway if there isn't progress made on a fiscal plan as a result of the issuance of up to $1 billion in as part of a 10-year capital program. This chart runs through the basic inputs that are in the top, the various existing payment obligations, in the bottom half of the chart, the projected general fund revenues. Those are all the inputs. That generates a 4% or 7% of the total amount for each fiscal year, and that's compared to the existing obligations, and so any difference. So, for example, 4% of the total is $173.3 million for FY 2021. The existing debt service is $101.5 million. That leaves $71.8 million, which could support an additional issuance of $908 million in bonds. And that then for each one of the subsequent years is adjusted either upward or downward depending on if the 4% of the total revenue either increases or decreases. That simple calculation results in just under $1.7 billion of theoretical capacity. And then we reduced that for reasons we discussed earlier, the fact that the state has to get significant recurring imbalance in its budget, and then the reduction as a result of uncertainty about how the percent of market value is going to impact the real, quote-unquote, unrestricted general fund revenue in the future. That concludes my discussion, Mr. Chair.
We have questions on this slide. Okay, we'll go on to the next slide, please.
And we already talked about this generally. We don't have any additional authority to issue direct state debt. That's for a couple of different reasons. The first one, that we sold all our general obligation bond authority at this point. The second is there was a Supreme Court decision on September 4th, 2020, which significantly changed our understanding of what might be possible from a state-supported bond structure perspective, and that decision invalidated a number of existing authorities to issue bonds, including the $300 million Kinnick Arm Crossing state-supported bond structure, the $1 billion Alaska Tax Credit Certificate Bond Corporation structure, the $1.5 billion Alaska Pension Obligation Bond Corporation structure. And that concludes my comments, Mr. Chair.
So these, just for clarity, all these bond authorizations that the legislature's approved are now mute? Kinnick Arm?
Yes.
All right. So everybody's clear. Any other questions on this slide?
Just one small question.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Do we need to discuss at all the Alaska Railroad bond debt outstanding? Is that even part of the equation at all? Has that been, I don't know, invalidated as well?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, I don't believe so. I think it's only structures, and if we jump forward to the next slide and the final two slides, I would explain that question's response.
Okay, go ahead and continue on to the next slide.
Okay. So maybe we could go to the slide after that, slide 18. And this was, so the litigation that was before the Supreme Court was specific to the Alaska Tax Credit Certificate Bond Corporation. And this structure contemplated the state committing itself to pay a sub-entity of the state on a subject to appropriation basis. And so in this case, the TCCB Corporation was going to enter into a contract with the Department of Revenue. And that contract was going to provide for annual payments in exchange for a lump sum payment today. And then those contractual payments would be committed through a trustee to bondholders, which would be the source of the lump sum payment. So the only source of revenue is the state of Alaska's general fund, and there's no reserve fund in place in this structure that creates a structure that's recognized as a within the bond market under the subject to appropriation category that the state has used for real property for a number of years, and there was a Supreme Court decision that determined that was legal. And so if you inserted real property in this chart in place of Alaska TCCB Corp, this, and you replace contractual payment with lease payments, this is legal, but it's no longer legal for this construct. And the railroad has its own revenues. It's not reliant upon the state for payment of its debt service. Shifting back to slide 17, I think we've discussed most of this. In that case, the Alaska Tax Credit Certificate Bond Corporation case was the result of those invalidations that we discussed on the prior slide. As far as other fallout as a result of that decision, there have been concerns raised about certain moral obligation structures as a result of statutory language that was provided within the Alaska Tax Credit Certificate Bond Corporation structure, kind of the throwing the kitchen sink at it. It wasn't going to be used, but it provided for a moral obligation structure within the statutory framework, which is the same that's relied upon by the bond bank, student loan, ADAs, the other potential issuers of moral obligation debt. But if you look at the final slide, the primary difference is that in a true moral obligation structure, if you look at the slide 19 in the upper right, you can see that municipal bonds are the source of the payments to the debt service fund. It's not coming from the state's general fund. And the state's commitment is really to the bond reserve fund in the event that the municipalities failed to pay. The legislature would be asked to consider replenishing the reserve fund. There's a number of steps, credit steps, and statutory solutions that would be applied before that would ever occur, but that's the fundamental difference between a state-supported structure and a moral obligation structure. And in fact, in this bond bank example, the bond bank's actually, per its statutes, supposed to pay any net revenue back to the state's general fund every year, and so you actually have an entity that winds up paying the state rather than the state paying its debt service. And so as a result of that uncertainty, there was a petition for rehearing that was filed with the Supreme Court on September 28th of 2020, and we're still waiting to see if the court will consider that or not. And, Mr. Chair, that concluded my comments on the last three slides.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any final questions for Mr. Mitchell? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Mitchell, for your presentation today. We'll be having you back, I'm sure, when we get into the bond package discussion in more detail. And we'll ask again to look at the historical bond load on the state, debt load, along with the marginal impact of the, whatever proposals in front of the committee. So with that, we'll go on to the second presenter. We're going to go a little over. We'll never get done here for the committee in 45 minutes, so we'll have a brief discussion at the end to see if what the committee wants to do. So we will now proceed on to an update on the state's cash flow reserve funds and discussion of the state cash flows with the Department of Revenue. We have the commissioner online. If she could introduce herself for the record, who she represents, and we'll give her as many lifelines as she may need.
Mr. Chair, this is Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue, and I'm here today with Pam Leary, the Director of the Treasury Division, and she will take the lead in presenting the next presentation, and I'll be available for questions. Thank you.
Okay, so we don't have the commissioner. We've got the trustee deputy and the Deputy Director of the Treasury Division. Is that correct, Mr. Barnhill?
That's correct.
Okay. Go ahead and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Stedman and members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Pam Leary, and I am the Director of the Treasury Division. We'll start today's presentation on slide 2, which is the agenda, which shows that we will be providing an update of our savings and investment funds. We'll discuss cash flows, and we'll also touch on revenue volatility management. skipping to slide 4 is what we have in the past referred to as the countdown clock. It is the number of days that Alaska could run on our total balances if we did not have revenues. So looking at the traditional cash reserve fund, the constitutional budget reserve fund, you see the estimated fiscal year 22 beginning balance is estimated to be $900 million. And that would provide 76 days or 2.5 months of coverage of the $4.3 billion operating budget. The other funds listed are funds that could be appropriated if it were deemed necessary, and that's the Power Cost Equalization Fund, the Higher Education Investment Fund, and other designated funds. If we add those to the mix, we have coverage of about 230 days or almost 8 months. Adding the earnings reserve account estimated beginning balance, less the $2 billion expected to be drawn for dividends in fiscal year 22 would bring our budget coverage to almost 3 years or 1,078 days.
And that concludes slide 4?
It does.
Okay, we have a question from Senator Wilikowski, and he had a previous concern, so if you could wrap that previous concern into your answer, please, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Well, my question right now is whether or not you believe that or whether or not you consider ADA to be a fund that could be turned to when the CBR is exhausted. Or can, I guess the general question is, can ADA be used to fund general fund obligations?
I'm going to defer to our Deputy Commissioner, Mr. Barnhill, on that.
Through the Chair, this is Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, the answer is yes.
Follow-up question?
The answer is yes. Is there a reason it's not included on this slide?
The reason it has not been included on the slide is these are the funds that we can turn to, or the legislature can turn to in fairly short order. There's no reason why we didn't include it other than that. We can update it to include those funds if you would like.
Senator Wilson.
Yeah, with that answer, does that then cripple ADA's ability to bond? Does that hurt their bond rating?
Through the Chair, Mike Barnhill again, Senator Wilson. My understanding from ADA is that use of ADA funds for non-ADA purposes has injured their bond rating in the past and would likely do so in the future.
Senator Wilikowski, does that your question and the preceding one answer your question, or do we need further explanation?
No, that's all for now, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I guess we'll go on to slide number 2, and then we'll, or excuse me, slide number 5, page 5.
Sure, again, and Pam Leary for the record. Slide 5 presents a graphic from the Pew study that shows the number of days each state could run on total balances, and this is a fiscal year 2019 slide. I'm sure fiscal year 20 will look somewhat different, but you can see that even with large draws, Alaska was second only to Wyoming in terms of days of expenses in funds, and the median of all 50 states is up from 40.4 days of coverage in 2018 to 49.7 in 2019. And I'm done with the slide unless there are questions. Slides 6 and 7 kind of continue on this topic of reserves and balances and coverages. So if you'd like me to move on to the next slide, I will.
Yeah, just pause and I'll cue you up. I got to watch the table.
Sure.
So does any of these other states have an endowment in significant size relative to the state as Alaska does with the permanent fund and the earnings reserve, or is this an anomaly?
I do believe Wyoming has a similar type of sovereign state, which is similar. And I think there are smaller sovereign endowments that are in some of the other states.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski.
Texas, I think.
Just curious how you came up. Just curious how this number came to be. It says 170.8 days, and by my rough calculation, you're figuring it about $11 million a day, and so this comes to about $2 billion in assets. And I know this isn't your calculation. This is from the Pew Charitable Trust, but it seems, does that seem accurate to you?
Could you help?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the amount is, I believe the presentation that Pew uses is based on a survey of all states, and I do actually believe that that is the constitutional budget reserve number that was used for total balances to be accessed in the survey.
So I think what we'll have you do is get the committee the data on this chart, and that should further help Senator Wilikowski and other committee members cross-reference the dollars and the time frame. Any other question on this chart? Go on to slide number 6, please.
Slide 6 provides another set of statistics from NASBO, the National Association State Budget Officers Fall Survey, and it shows how much coverage savings reserves funds provide as a percentage of budget expenditures. The survey reported that percentages increased since 2008, when the median balance was only 4.8% of coverage, and it was expected to be a high of 8.4% for fiscal year 2021, but that was prior to the pandemic, and I do know that some states have dipped into the reserves as a result of the pandemic, so I'm sure we'll see the 2021 results next year. The table presented also shows that about a third of the states have a reserve that covers 10% or more of their expenditures. And as of the expected fiscal year 22 expenditures, the budget reserve fund will represent about 22% of the budget.
Questions on this slide? Next slide, please.
Slide 7 outlines several considerations in determining cash reserve balances, and the table provides context by showing cash reserves for a handful of comparative states and what a elastic balance would be if these states' rules were applied. Of course, the context of most state reserve funds is to assist with filling short-term cash flow or revenue shortfall needs and not to be used for structural deficits, as our Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund has recently been used. I think one of the big takeaways is the second bullet point, where Pew Trust essentially targets three factors. The defined purpose of what the fund is it for cash flow, revenue shortfall, or a combination? What the volatility of a state's tax revenue is. And in prior years, we've shown a slide where we were looking at oil tax volatility, and Alaska being very much at the top of that chart. It definitely has come down, as we'll look later on in the presentation, but that is something to be looked at in terms of what type of fund you have and how much should be in it. And also the level of coverage. So similar to an insurance policy, how much insurance do you want to have in your for your budget in a reserve account? So is it 10%, 20%? Is it based on revenue? Is it based on expenses? There's definitely no one size fits all. The Government Finance Officers Association also has some guidance in terms of minimums and caps. But each state has a different set of circumstances. And this has been obviously a big discussion for the past few years within our department, and different models have been identified to try to estimate the reserve balances, but until there's some clarity regarding how the reserve is going to be used, it is really difficult to determine what a reserve balance should be. And so once we have some clarity on what is coming in terms of what components of revenue there are, I think it's really hard to determine what the volatility around each of those are and develop a reserve number.
Well, we're going to be asking you for a reserve number here. I can assure you that, so you might want to give it some thought. Next slide, please.
Slides 8 through 19 provide historical asset balances and investment statistics for funds managed by the Treasury Division. And so we'll start with the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. I have two slides. Slide 8 shows the balance and also provides information about the formation of the CBR, which was in 1990, and that appropriations from the CBRF come from the legislature to cover budget revenue shortfalls, and it's also used to fund temporary cash flow expense and expense revenue mismatches throughout the year, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later in the presentation. All appropriations from the CBRF must be repaid. The blue area is for what we call the main CBR fund, which is what remains today. The yellow part of the chart was for the sub-fund of the CBR, which was a fund that was created to target a higher rate of return for the assets in that fund. And in April of 2015, it was determined that those funds would be needed for budget purposes and other purposes. So the subfund was moved into the main fund at that point, and at June 30 of 2020, the balance was $1.9 billion, and I will say that that balance is a cash investment balance, which is different from what you would see in the CAPR or the budget because of the nature of cash. What we're reporting in all of these slides are what's at the bank. So it's a particular point in time. And that concludes my comments on this slide.
Can you remind me why you did not have the SBR included on this chart, the statutory budget reserve?
The SBR was a part of the general fund. In terms of investments, it was a sub-fund. It was broken out. Can't remember the year for that, but the slide that you have, that was the handout that shows the SBR as well as the CBR, it was managed separately for a period of time, and then it was brought back into the general fund when there was very little amount left in the fund to be used, so it had a different investment structure. It's just not included here because it was a separate fund.
You could please restate this chart, add that to it, and you can put a footnote on it to delineate it. It is a separate issue, you say, a subcomponent of the general fund, but it was activated to supplement the CBR with a lower vote threshold. So it was viewed by the committee as just another savings account, no different than the CBR, other than it had different criteria to access it. In other words, a lower vote threshold, simple majority versus a three-quarter vote. And it just will help highlight the magnitude of the savings that we have walked through the last several years and the unsustainable.
Sure, we can add that for you. And I believe it was 2013 to 2015 that it was a separate fund that was managed.
Senator Bonimo.
Mr. Chair, this is Mike Barnhill for the record. The CBR, the SBR is set out on page 14, and we can certainly move the depiction of the SBR on page 14 to this page.
Okay. Okay. Go ahead, Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So I'm just looking at the last bottom bullet point. Appropriations from the CBR must be repaid. Or what? What are the consequences? Do we get penalized? Is this going to cost us money? And how long do we have? Perpetuity? 3 years? 5 years? 50 years?
Right. Can you answer the question, please, as far as the interest rate and the time frame set on the amortization of the debt?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, Mike Barnhill again. This bullet point simply reflects the constitutional requirement for repayment of the CBR. There is no time period. There is no interest rate.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions on this slide? We'll go on to slide number nine.
Slide number nine provides some investment statistics on the Constitutional Budget Reserve. And I apologize, there is a mistake here at the top in terms of the investment objective. It says moderate risk. That is now a low risk, as indicated by the target asset allocation, which is purely cash equivalents at this point. Last year, it was more moderate. There were equity and other fixed income components to the target allocation, but it is now 100% of cash equivalent target without having the knowledge and uncertainty of when that money is going to be used. That was deemed to be the best approach for the fund. The market value down kind of in the middle section shows the balances, again, the cash balances at the bank as of December 31st, 2020. There was a $1 billion balance.
Senator Von Imhoff?
In terms of return, sorry?
We can go on. We can pick the pace up here. We understand the risk level issue. Senator Von Imhoff?
Okay, great.
I got my answer.
Okay, thank you.
In terms of returns, the one-year return was 1.51%. The projected 10-year return is 2.25%, and that concludes my comments on this slide.
Okay, thank you. We're on to slide 10, please.
Slide 10 shows the power cost equalization, historical invested assets. The purpose of the fund is to provide a long-term stable financing source that provides affordable levels of electric utility costs for otherwise high-cost service areas of the state. In June of 2016, the SB 196 changed the target from 7% to 5%. Of the monthly average value of the fund of the previous three fiscal years for appropriation. The balance as of June 30 was about $1.1 billion. And if you'd like to, just I can roll into slide 11 to talk about the investment statistics.
That would be fine.
Slide 11 shows that the investment objective is has a high risk tolerance. It shows that there's about a 60% equity to 40% fixed income target asset allocation. Down at the bottom, you can see the projected 10-year return of 5% and the one-year rolling average at 1231 the rate of return at 1231 is 7.76%.
We have Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like the PCE fund's been flat since around 2018. Can you explain why? And also on the Callan's 10-year projection, it also has trended down from last year from 6.58 to 5. Can you explain that as well?
I can. Since 2016, the fund has actually been increasing somewhat, but not a lot, and it is because of the return. The earnings and the growth rate are just slightly above the amounts that have been appropriated. With respect to the target year return, that is developed with the investment team and with the commissioner's approval in terms of the target asset allocation. And for the last year, there has been somewhat of a change in the allocation and what the target of each of the asset classes has been. And so there is certainly somewhat of a downturn in terms of what Callan projected. Last year, I believe there was a 70% equity to 30% fixed income combination, and now it's moved into 60%, 40%. And I believe that was done just to mitigate some of the risk tolerance. Okay. That was anticipated.
Any other questions on this? You see, some of these funds for the committee members we'll be dealing with later on in the session also, more detail, but nice review. Go on to slide 12, please.
Sure. Slide 12 shows the Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund, which was capitalized in 2012 with a $400 million deposit from AHCC for use in paying performance scholarship awards and education grants. There's a 7% appropriation for those funds that is available. And the balance at June 30 was $344 million. And moving to slide 13, if there are no questions, you can see the investment statistics. This has a high risk tolerance. This fund does target the 70% equity, 30% fixed income asset allocation. Its projected 10-year returns is more in line with a 70% 30 split of 6.37%. The one-year returns as of 12/31 were 15%, and the balance at 12/31 was $391 million.
And if you could help me understand the definition of high risk, you're using high risk for both the PCE, the power cost equalization, and the higher ed fund, and where higher ed has 30% or bonds and PCE has 60%, and that's a significant allocation difference with the same risk tolerance definition. So if you could put some documents together to help the committee understand what's being used as classification of high risk. Senator Wilson.
Sure, and I will be happy to do that. There is most definitely a range of what high risk is. And I think one of the reasons why the power cost equalization asset allocation was changed was because the statutory earnings requirement was reduced. And we also look at the time horizon, which is fairly long for both of these funds. But one obviously has a slightly higher risk tolerance on the continuum, and that's the Higher Education Investment Fund. And so it has a higher target rate of return and has more equities involved. But we can provide kind of either a discussion document or the basis for how these asset allocations are identified in the investment team and approved by our fiduciary, the commissioner.
Right, that would be helpful with they're both in perpetuity and there's significant allocation difference. So if you could help us understand that, that would be beneficial. Senator Wilson, do you have a question? Okay. We'll go on. No, seeing no other questions, we'll go on to slide 14.
Sure. Slide 14 represents the general fund and other non-segregated investments, or we call it by its acronym, the GFONSI. It includes the general fund proper, which is our state operating account or working capital account, plus other non-segregated funds. And all of these are invested in a pool environment. We have two components of the GFONSI, GFONSI 1 and then GFONSI 2. And GFONSI 2 was created in 2018 to target a slightly higher risk return profile for a subset of funds that could have a longer time horizon and appetite for risk. There are about 185 funds that are invested together in a pool, but they're accounted for separately in the state accounting system. And here you can also see the SBR, as Deputy Commissioner Barnhill mentioned, was part of the JIF funds before and after being managed as a separate fund. And that is shown on slide 14 in the yellow part of the graph.
Right, and if you can restate that other previous chart so we can see a chart with the SBR included with the CBR, and I recognize the management and location difference, but there's also a different viewpoint here at the table of wanting to look at it as both of them as a savings mechanism. I'd like you to help me a little bit before I get into questions. In 2012, there was $9 billion in Jafonzi. Now we're down to $3.5 billion. That's $6 billion drop. In the SBR, we know we liquidated. It went from 2.6 down to zero. So that's about a $9 billion decline. Can you help us understand that magnitude of decline, particularly in the Jafonzi funds?
Sure. There is a combination, Chair Stedman, of factors that result in the difference. One is that some of the funds in the Jafonzi had higher balances and are now being managed to a lower amount. The same is certainly true for the general fund. There was not as strict an eye on maintaining money in the general fund proper or the operating account and keeping that balance lower. And that has since, I would say, 2015 been more the structure that the cash management group has been maintaining in terms of calling cash to the operating fund for payment of day-to-day expenses. So I think that's the majority of what happened. I will also point out that on this slide, and we can change this going forward as well, it includes the higher education fund, because that's how we report it. So there's about $400 million in the slide since its inception that is the higher education fund. So the number is actually a little bit lower. It's about $2.5 billion as of June 30, 2020.
Hey, I'm still having challenges here. I understand your last comments about the education fund. I'm curious on trying to identify where the cash, roughly $6 billion went from 2012 to 2020 that comprised your decline in your blue section of the chart, and we have available the Jafonzi funds accounts. Maybe you can help the committee members, particularly myself, that's a little confused on this, understand that a little better as far as where those funds went. It seemed to be a significant dollar amount.
The simple answer is that the funds were spent, and there wasn't as rigorous an effort to maintain a lower balance in the general fund proper. If you'd like us to kind of lay out a comparison of what those funds were at the time, we can, but the answer is that the funds were spent.
Right, if you could help me with that, because the concern that I have and some of the other committee members is the burn rate of cash. And when we advance through our savings in the CBR and the SBR, and here, you know, that's where I have this question of this other $6 billion. What is the actual burn rate that's going on, and how long can we survive this? Obviously, it's a lot shorter time horizon than it was 6 years ago, and some of us are concerned it's only a couple, 2-3 years out in front of us before we're going to have significant issues. Senator Von Imhoff.
So thank you. I think just on this particular comment, when you start looking in the last 8 years or so, and you look at UGF, which is undesignated general funds, which is in essence the general fund, and then designated general funds, you will see that there is a cost shift between UGF to DGF, which is, I think, what we're talking about here. Some of the programs have remained intact, some of the services have remained intact, and just the source of the funds have switched. So it may appear that the UGF, our general fund spending, is in fact down, which is true in many cases. But it's just the programs, in fact, have not gone away. They are just being supported by DGF, and we are spending down those balances, which you've aptly pointed out. It's my interpretation.
Right. So we'll clarify this with the help of the department. I think it'll help us in the final conclusion over the next couple of months as we work through this issue. And we are having some work done on that very subject, Senator Von Hoff, you're well aware of the comparative differences, and we'll bring that, as mentioned before, to the committee, looking back 3-4 years and looking forward 3-4 years. Other questions on this slide? Okay, we can go on to slide. I think you might have already finished up on 15.
Do you have
any other comments on 15? That'd be fine. If not, we'll go on to slide 16.
Yes, I do.
You want 15?
Yes.
Okay, we'll go to 15. Ms. Leary, you want to give us any high points on slide 15? And Senator Von Imhoff has a question.
Sure. You can see we have the Jafonzi 1 and the Jafonzi 2 investment statistics laid out here. The combined total at the end of December was $2.5 billion. The one-year return as of 12/31 was 1.49% for the Jafonzi 1 and 3.51% for the Jafonzi 2. And the projected 10-year returns are 2.38% for the Jafonzi 1 funds and 2.78%, slightly higher, for the Jafonzi 2.
Okay. Senator Von Imhoff.
Yes, so taking a look at the Constitutional Budget Reserve back in slide 9, which you had moderate risk, but I think you stated in your comments that it is low risk. So if low risk and the Callan projected return for the CBR is 2.25, yet the two Jafonzi funds are moderate risk and moderate to high risk, and the Callan is 2.38 and 2.78 respectively. I fear that the CBR, Callan projected 10-year return of 2.25, is probably too high, particularly when we've had Mr. Mitchell in our previous presentation discuss repeatedly how low rates are. And if you have everything in cash equivalents, I just don't really see how we can get a return, especially you see in the last 3 months, 6 months, it's less than 1%. So this is something we should think about, Mr. Chairman, because we are depending on the CBR, and we'll do so with the supplemental. We'll do so with this particular upcoming budget in fiscal year 22, and we just need to, I think, have a little bit more realistic return horizons. Thank you.
Okay, we'll go on then. I think it was more of a comment, correct? We'll go on to
That's correct. Thank
we'll
you.
Go on to slide 16, please.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Stedman. This year we've added back to our endowment funds, just an explanation of the public school trust as well as the pension funds, which we just want you to have an update of what they are in terms of their balances. The public school trust fund was $688 million as of June 30. It was established in 1978. You know, the history, about 0.5% continues to go into of mineral leases and royalties into this fund. As of 2018 and HB 2013, the fund is now managed as an endowment under a percentage of market value method, with 5% of the average market value of the 5 years preceding the last fiscal year as the appropriation limit. Each year, the investment team does some analysis and works with the education department to determine what amount is recommended not to exceed that 5%. Moving on to slide 17, if that's fine. You can see that this is also a more long-term investment horizon, so it has a little bit of a higher risk. You can see the target allocation includes more like a 70% 29% target of equity to fixed income in its asset allocation, which is pretty much the highest asset allocation target that we have in any of our funds, similar to the Higher Education Fund. The 1 year 1231 return was 15%, and the balance as of December 31st was $778 million, roughly.
If you could add this allocation to the previous question I had about the different weightings in fixed income with the same high risk classification. Here we're down to 26% fixed income, and we have the same risk allocation in a fund in perpetuity. It just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. So we'll work on that with you so we can understand it. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So just a reminder, I can't remember. Senator Bishop, I think we passed the bill last year, the lottery raffle bill, that some of the money goes to the public school trust fund. Does the money, in fact, go to the public school trust fund? Is that the fund that this permanent fund lottery goes into? So that's why we're seeing some of the balances go up?
It is not actually. It's purely the earnings of this fund offsetting, obviously, the appropriations. But there are separate funds that are set aside for the Lottery Education Fund.
Okay. We'll go on to slide 18. And
Mr. Chair, this is Mike Barnhill. If I could just interject a comment before we go on to PERS TERS. So we've gone over now the what we call the state funds. These are funds that are invested by the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. And, Mr. Chair, as you know, you have long counseled the Department to add a layer of governance to the Commissioner's investment of these funds. And I'm pleased to announce to the committee that Commissioner Mahoney has indeed now done that very explicitly. And we have entered into contracts with each member of the PERS-TERS Investment Advisory Committee. There's three of them to provide that governance as an advisory committee for the commissioner, and they're now meeting quarterly to discuss the investments of these funds.
And I assume and hope that is broader than just, when you say these funds, just the PERS and TERS, but it's also to assist the revenue commissioner in other decisions that she may make?
It is, this particular committee is specifically for the purpose of advising the commissioner with respect to the investment of the state funds. Those are the funds we just discussed, public school trust funds, Jafondi 1 and 2, power cost equalization, constitutional budget reserve.
I thank you for that, Mr. Barnhill. It's something that I've brought up and been concerned about for several years. I'm clear back to the end of the Murkowski administration. I think that will help the commissioner, whoever the commissioner may be, and give them more comfort in the decisions that they make, and also when inevitably a decision may not, in hindsight, turn out to be the best that could have been made, or I guess the most profitable, or what have you, in hindsight. It will allow the commissioner then to show a rationale to that decision to the committee, which is frankly what some of us were concerned about, that there was an awful lot of authority in the Commissioner of Revenue, and it just helps to have some sounding boards when you have that much authority for the best interest of the state.
Agree 100%, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, we don't expect perfect decisions. That's just so it's clear to the public. Just the most informed decision they can make. Can we briefly talk about these next two slides? Because we're going to have the PERS and TERS group in front of us here in a few days. We'll go into more detail, and we can move on then to the other pertinent issues.
Absolutely, Chair Stedman. Slide 18 shows both the PERS in blue, the Public Employees Retirement System, and TERS, the Teachers Retirement System, in yellow, and the balances throughout their existence since 1991. The defined benefit plans are currently experiencing outflows from the funds. The total as of June 30, 2020 was $26.5 billion, and that's for the defined benefit plans that are shown here. There's also the participant-directed plans, the defined contribution, SES, deferred comp, that's totaling about $7.2 billion as of the end of the fiscal year. I'll move on to slide 19 for the statistics on the investments. And you can see that at the end of 12/31/2020, there was 19.5 in the PERS system defined benefit plans and 9.4 billion in the teachers, so a combined total of about 30.3 billion in the defined benefit plans, and then an additional 8.3 billion in the participant directed plans. And that's an increase of $3.8 billion in the defined benefit plans, even though there are still net withdrawals coming out of PERS and TERS. The returns as of September 30, 2020, we don't have the December returns quite yet, as they are produced by our returns consultant, Callan. The 1 year as of September was 7.12% for PERS and a similar number for TERS of 7.10%.
Okay. We have questions from Senator Wilkowski.
I'm just wondering, since we're getting to the end of these slides, if we could get a similar type of pie chart and return for ADA, for the ADA account?
For the what account?
ADA. ADA.
Oh, the ADA account?
Yeah.
Yes, we could. We'll work with the. Yes, we'll figure out if we go to ADA or we'll go through the revenue, whatever, but we'll get that information.
Thank you.
We should probably have a future hearing on ADA itself. But we could have some preliminary data put together, Senator Wilkowski, to prepare for that, if that's all right.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chair, this is Mike Barnhill. Just for the record, the Treasury Division does not manage ADA funds, but we can reach out and ask them to provide that information.
It might be helpful, Mr. Barnhill, just to for the information to, you know, be kind of correlated together in the way it's presented for the committee. And then we'll like I said, we'll have a whole nother hearing process on ADA itself. It might be helpful. But we'll work with you on that, Mr. Barnhill, and then ADA. So we have just a couple minutes left. We've got about 9 slides left. And I'm just curious what the committee, if they want to take a break and pick up at 1 o'clock, or they want to try to finish this off.
Finish it off.
Okay. Let's go ahead and finish it off. If the committee members want to take a brief, break themselves, that's fine. We'll try to plow through this, if it's all right with the deputy treasurer and the deputy commissioner, or the treasury director and the deputy commissioner. Okay, let's go.
Move to slide 21, I think, is the next slide with some information on it.
Okay.
And that is pretty much my disclaimer and reminder that the funds that the Treasury manage are cash balances and not what is necessarily available to spend. I think last year we talked about, you know, if your bank account says you have $1,000, but your Aunt Sally gave you a check for $200 for your birthday, but you also paid a utility bill of $400, the reality is you don't have $1,000. You really have $800 to spend. And so our numbers are the numbers at the bank, kind of like the $1,000, whereas the $800 is really kind of when you look at all of the expenditures that you have and the revenues coming in, like what you owe and what you're getting in at the end of the day.
So let's leave that level of explanation to the other finance committee, and let's ratchet it up a little bit for this finance committee.
Sure. I just want to make it perfectly clear that, you know, often when you see numbers from OMB, those are accrual numbers, or from Division of Finance with the CAFR, those are accrual numbers. And And we tend to just tell you what the money is sitting in the bank at the particular point in time that we're discussing. So I'll move on to slide 22, which also may be knowledge already known. It's just a depiction of how money flows into the Treasury. And the simple explanation is that pretty much all the money comes in and all the money comes out of the state operating fund as a stopping place, going to or coming from other funds or outside entities. And so there is a lot of money coming in and a lot of money coming out on any given day. I've spared you the charts that we used last year that show outflows and inflows of cash because I think it's not as important as the revenue and expense numbers that you have been looking at. But in the future, if you would like to see some of that information, I am happy to do that. But I can move on to slide 23 if there are no questions.
We have a question on this little picturama there, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. We had some testimony a few days ago about corporate income tax payments that the state would have to make, and I guess the number's a bit unclear, but it could be over $100 million. Where is that money coming from?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that the money would be coming from the general fund.
From where?
The general fund.
General fund.
The actual payments would come from the general fund.
And does that require a legislative appropriation?
Mr. Chair, this is Mike Barnhill. I'll take that question. Historically, the Department of Revenue Tax Division has paid refunds and any payments going out to taxpayers by reversing the deposit entry. So it does not require an appropriation. It's simply a reversal of a payment to the general fund that was made previously.
Okay. Thank you. We'll call that an expensive journal entry. So let's go on to slide 23, cash flow deficiencies.
Sure. On slide 23 is a discussion, starts the discussion of cash flow deficiencies. And I think Senator Von Imhoff's comment about UGF and DGF funds is particularly pertinent here. In the past, a lot of the funds stayed in the general fund proper, the working capital account. But over time, there have been established many sub-funds for different purposes and programs. And so there was less cash available to pay day-to-day operating costs in the general fund. And so one of the big cash flow components that we look at are the mismatches between when money comes in and when money goes out. And that can happen for a number of reasons. I have a few examples listed here, such as the federal programs that require you to spend the money before you get reimbursed for it. So money will go out the door before money comes in. Similarly, we have many appropriations that are expenses are made at the beginning of the year, and so that does not match incoming revenue across the year. Example of that is the state pension payments that are above the caps that the pension plan employers pay. And so that number is roughly $340 million, and it has historically been paid at the beginning of the year. And there are also some seasonal cash flow needs where summer is that peak season for construction projects, for example, and seasonal workers. So part of the deficiencies in cash available at any given time may not match what we need to pay out, and that results in calls of money from our other funds. Currently, we are looking at two sources for years where we have deficits in the budget. We generally will take that deficit spending amount from the constitutional budget reserve if it's available. And now with SB 26, we look to the earnings reserve account and the POMV payment to replenish the money that is in our cash operating accounts.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, on those corporate net operating loss payments, do you know if the corporations will be getting the same net operating loss refunds on both their state and federal taxes?
I don't know the answer to that question, Mr. Barnhill.
Mike Barnhill, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't know that we have any line of sight on federal income tax impacts. But we can check and get back to the committee.
If you could check and try to get back to us on the, because of corporate, right, if you could just check and get back to us for clarity, because I think that subject will be coming up probably several times over the next couple of months as we try to understand that. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to flag for the department, I'm not convinced that these don't require legislative appropriation. This is not like a simple accounting reconciliation. This is a windfall to these corporations. And so I think the state needs to be very careful about issuing these because I'm not sure that they don't require legislative appropriation, Mr. Chairman. And we're doing some research on that right now.
Okay, I would expect so. So we'll wait till we get those opinions back, Senator Wilikowski, and we'll work through this issue for clarity. The whole interconnection between our state corporate tax rate and the federal rate is, I think, the question at hand, and the inability that we have to control what the federal level, what they do with their corporate rate structure and how it flows back to the state. So I think that's the crux of the issue, other than the dollars, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, and my understanding is the department knew about this at least back in last May, and I'm curious if they're I guess I'm curious why you didn't take any action since then, and do you plan on taking any action, legal, changing the laws rather to fix this situation?
Okay, if we could, Mr. Barnhill, it's kind of not the subject for today, but if the committee or the department could get back to the committee on the timeline and the structure of this issue itself. It's wrapped up in the COVID response at the federal level, and maybe help us with a timeline so we can better understand the flow of this. It has been no secret that there was the issue out there with this corporate tax structure.
Mr. Chair, Mike Barnhill, two quick comments. Number one, yes, there's a plan. Timing, stay tuned. And then with respect to the refunds, my understanding could be incorrect, but my understanding is the practice of reversing entries in order to pay refunds is of long-standing origin. My first experience with that was when Wilson Condon was Commissioner of Revenue, so that dates back at least 20 years. Certainly welcome legal attention to this, and we'll review whatever your counsel provides. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll work on this issue, but let's move on. Slide 24.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Slide 24 is a discussion about the Memorandum of Understanding that was developed in 1994 between the Departments of Revenue Administration, OMB, and Law. It's updated as needed. It was created to provide context and a workflow of what happens when a cash deficiency is identified. Currently, the minimum cash threshold that we target in the general fund proper, our operating account, is $400 million in minimum cash. And that number is derived simply by looking at how many, if we could cover 2 days of a perfect storm of high volume outflows of cash. And what happens on a day-to-day basis is we look at what's coming in, we look at what is expected to go out, and anytime our forecast shows 5 days of potentially going under that 400 minimum balance, we call for money. And again, it could be the SBR in the past has been used, the CBR, and the Earnings Reserve Fund now, which is now part of the operating and part of the revenue structure. It also outlines the procedures for addressing the cash flow timing mismatches. Again, we look at monthly cash projections, and that includes information from the tax division in terms of revenues, which also includes the net losses and anything that's happening that might impact the revenue balance or money going out. And we, again, have temporary interfund borrowing. And in the event of a true revenue shortfall, which happened, I believe, in the 1990s, we would seek legislative action to access additional funds through appropriation. If that does not resort in funds, we would start to prioritize disbursements and restrict expenditures.
Senator von Imhoff has a question here. I'm assuming it's going to be the ERA. If not, I'll ask that one, but Senator von Imhoff.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Mine's more of just a general question. The second bullet point, it says updated as needed. I'm assuming that it's an update between the legislature and the Department of Revenue. And if, in fact, that is the case, is your department, through the Dunleavy administration, going to submit a proposal of this updated memorandum of understanding?
Through the chair, Senator von Imhoff, the memorandum of understanding is really between the Departments of Revenue Administration, OMB, and the law. And it is updated as needed, either for the minimum cash threshold or occasionally it's when we new commissioners want to take a look at it. And if we have different sources of revenue, like the earnings reserve was added, I think last year or the year before, I can't recall, as a resource when SB 26 came into effect.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Yes.
So that was my lead-in question. It says, in the event of a revenue shortfall, seek legislative action. So is the legislature going to be involved at all on this, or is it a threshold? And if so, what is the threshold that the legislature is involved to the SBR is no longer in existence, so we have the CBR and the ERA. Is these four departments that you have on top, are they the ones that are going to make the decision on which accounts and how much, or does the legislature get to be involved at all?
Ken, let me handle this one. Through the chair,
sure.
Barnhill, Senator von Imhoff. So there's a critical distinction that we're trying to draw here between cash flow timing mismatches. This is where we're expecting the revenue to come in. It's just not coming in time to pay an expense. And so all organizations have this, and so there are various mechanisms we can use to solve that. At the end of the year, in that kind of situation, we would expect revenues and expenses to balance. In Alaska's case, we also have a very profound issue with revenue shortfall. And as we continue to draw down the CBR, that issue becomes more critical. And so in those cases where it's not a cash flow timing mismatch, but instead it's a revenue shortfall, and if during the fiscal year we determine that there will not be revenues sufficient to pay expenses, and there's no appropriation like we've had in the past from a CBR or some account to backstop the missing revenues, then we need to go to the legislature and seek appropriation from another fund source. It's our job as the Department of Revenue to keep a line of sight on when that situation arises. In the past, we've always had the CBR and a backstop from the CBR. At some point in the future, we may not have the CBR, or we may have a revenue shortfall that exceeds the balance of the CBR. It's our job to tell you when that is and come to you and seek an appropriation.
Okay, so we're going to finish up here in 15 minutes max, but I would hope on your last sentence of your comment that the committee would have the foresight and the information flow to them to anticipate this shortfall and deal with it beforehand so it doesn't exist rather than after the fact. That's the goal here. So with that, Mr. Barnhill, can we go on to 25 and let's finish up in 15 minutes max?
We can do that. And I think also just a comment on the memorandum of understanding, as Mr. Barnhill said, that is our job, is to forecast and to see what's happening with the cash flow. And back in 1999, there was a cap on the amount of borrowing, which resulted in the department coming back to the legislature to ask for, I think, additional funds of the CBR to mitigate having to determine which expenditures would get paid, which ones would not, and a potential shutdown. So definitely we are working towards looking at the playing field and would come to the legislature to let you know ahead of time what we're seeing. On slide 25, we discuss further that the budget reserve funds have been the solution for both the cash flow timing mismatches as well as the revenue shortfalls or our structural deficits right now. And the appropriations, as Mr. Barnhill said, the backstop provision in the language that the legislature produces annually in the operating budget, provides for revenue shortfalls, and the CBR is a backstop. And Treasury has also relied on this appropriation to use the budget reserve funds to address timing cash flow mismatches. Just a couple of other points of information from history. The CBR was fully repaid as of fiscal year 2010, and borrowing from the CBR recommenced in fiscal year 14. And based on the CAFR, the fiscal year 19 CAFR, the CBR was owed $12.6 billion.
Okay. Next slide, please. Or the one after the
sure.
next slide.
We're now going to discuss revenue volatility management on slide 27. This is a very important slide, in my opinion. We have gone from a heavily reliant state on petroleum revenues. Last year, 28% of our unrestricted general fund revenues came from petroleum revenues, and now it's 19%. Uncertainty exists all the time in petroleum revenues. We'll always have that uncertainty when it comes to that revenue stream as a commodity. And although it can be modeled and forecasted, there is great volatility there. The other major bullet point is recognition that now our revenue, we have 72% of our revenue coming from investment funds, and that's predominantly the earnings reserve account, and uncertainty exists for the percentage of market value formula that comes out of it in any given year. But obviously there's uncertainty for years beyond that. And as the budget stands right now, the PONV formula, 100% of it is going to go to the state finances. And so that certainty exists. But obviously, that component may change depending upon the legislator's actions.
Mr. Chair, this is Mike Barnhill. If I could just add an additional comment. You know, through SB 26, the state has dramatically reduced its revenue volatility, and now we have this certainty for 70% of our needs for a fiscal year. And so, you know, I just want to, again, say thank you to this committee and the legislature from 2018. This was an incredibly important step for the state of Alaska to take.
Okay. Next slide, please.
Slide 28 shows current volatility management techniques. Obviously, our cash reserves and other fund balances, if necessary, can be drawn on to offset the revenue volatility. And the last two bullet points, managing the timing of the earning reserve draws and transfers to the general fund is a way to manage our cash flow volatility, as well as managing the timing of expenditures, which we have done in the past in terms of certain payments, like the public school education fund. We have gone from taking that of entire appropriation and paying it out at the beginning of the year to a more monthly approach, so minimizing the impact on the cash flows. And we've done that with a couple of expenditures that that was possible with. But bullet point two, I just wanted to point out, I think Mr. Mitchell spoke about revenue anticipation notes. And one tool that we could use is to adopt maybe commercial paper and lines of credit as a resource in addressing some of the short-term cash flow needs. That concludes my comments on slide 28.
Or we fix the structural deficit issue and swing this ship in the proper direction. Senator Von Imhoff.
I know that I'm looking at time. I just want to be careful. Manage timing of expenditures. You know, there is an expectation if you're going to have net 30, net 60, there's no need to be pushing things to net 90, net 120 just for the state's purposes. I mean, there's people who receive this money that are counting on this money, and it keeps the economy going. So it's one thing to slow play, which I've seen the state do in the past with Medicaid expenditures. Just be thoughtful about it.
Any other final comments from the presenters? I think that concludes your presentation. Is that correct?
Takeaway slide.
Slide 29 just provides the takeaways from the presentations. If you'd like me to go through those, I can.
You can, yes.
The takeaways are that declining cash reserves will continue to be a concern if budget deficits continue, and you are well aware of this issue, as we all are, and support identifying a way to address the structural budget deficits and for the Treasury to be able to rely on the reserves for cash flow needs. And another takeaway is that even if the budget is balanced and all revenue is received, well, our cash flow timing mismatches may still occur. We also know that cash flow forecasting is always wrong, and revenue shortfalls may occur if those forecasted assumptions are wrong. Higher revenue volatility requires greater cash reserves until volatility decreases, and that has become more and more true as time has gone on. And so once we can address the structural deficits and identify what the reserve balance is really going to be used for, I think we'll have a better idea of being able to figure out how much should be in that reserve. And the final takeaway is that volatility management techniques are available. We're using them where and when we can. And there are others that are out there, but for now, we are using the tools that are in our toolbox to the best of our ability. And that concludes the presentation.
Do you have any final questions? So if we redefine structural deficit to future revenue, does that help your problem solution?
Mr. Chair, this is Mike Barnhill. For the record, I'm not sure I quite follow what you mean by redefine. But given the structural deficit, the basic tools are new revenues, budget reductions, change the PFD formula.
All right. It was just a tie-in to the previous presentation the day before where we had a future deficit and it was couched as future revenue. So I don't think couching it as future revenue helps the Department of Revenue pay the bills. That's the concern we have here. We have to work to at the table. We have to have the cash to make the payroll. And we are deficient in that the last several years. Reoccurring cash to make our reoccurring payroll. So we'll work on that issue, that, and hopefully we'll come up with some solutions and conclusions over the next couple months. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and thank the Department of Revenue for their presentation today and their help. We look forward to, you know, have them getting back to us with some of their answers to some of our questions, and then we'll bring up some of these other items as we go forward. We will be having presentations on the retirement system. We'll have presentation from ADA, some other things as we put these pieces together, but these last few days and the next couple are foundation days. So that concludes the meeting today. I appreciate the members staying late to get this done. Apologize for running late. We're just trying to compress our overall time frame to try to get our budget work done in the first through the middle of March. So with that, we'll see everybody tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. SB 50, Senate Bill 50, capital budget introduction by the OMB director.
Hi, sir.
We are adjourned.